I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Nolan Bushnell, founder of the gaming company Atari and Chuck E. Cheese restaurant chain. Nolan is considered one of the pioneers of the video game industry, having created the first coin-operated game, as well as Atari's debut game, Pong. Nolan is the author of Finding the Next Steve Jobs. He gave Steve his first job at Atari before Steve started Apple in 1976. Welcome.
It's my pleasure.
Now, while we were doing a sound check before starting the interview, you started to recite the words from The Jabberwocky, a nonsense poem by Lewis Carroll from the novel Through the Looking Glass.
It's a really surprising sound check that people that I do on occasion. The Jabberwock with eyes of flame came whiffling through the tonguey wood and burbled as it came. 1, 2, 1, 2, and through he took his vorpal blade, went snicker snack. He left it dead, and with its head he went clumping back.
Have you memorized a number of poems and excerpts of stories?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we used to do this thing with car trips with a lot of kids. You were always going to give kids 20 or 30 bucks on a vacation. So while we were getting there, I would always make the kids memorize poems, for which they'd get $5. And so by the time you get there, the kids would all know a certain amount of poems. And they've all said that they thought it was stupid at the time, but they really appreciated it ultimately.
Now, when you were growing up, you were one of four.
Correct.
Did your parents also create a game-like environment?
We played a lot of games when I was growing up. It was a ability that we had to constantly sort of mess around and play on an intellectual level. Like, I learned to play chess when I was, like, first grade.
Your mother was a teacher, and your father was in the concrete business.
That's correct.
What exactly did they do?
They primarily did curb and gutter and sidewalks.
Would you ever work with the concrete just in your own time and create things with the concrete?
Oh, yeah.
Like what?
Well, I went through a bomb-making phase where I, in my backyard, I created a blockhouse. If you're going to set off bombs, you don't want to get hurt.
Your father died when you were 15 years old. What role did you play in the company after he died?
I finished up all his contracts and then sold the equipment and closed the business down.
Why was the onus or the opportunity placed on you to do it versus somebody else in your family?
Well, all I had were sisters. It was a Mormon household, and the male is considered to be the big honcho. But I also knew the business, from ordering the concrete to setting up the forms to dealing with the surveyors. It just seemed normal.
Incidentally, you grew up in a Mormon household, and you now have 8 children. Did your religion play a role in your wanting to have as many children as you do?
I had become an agnostic heathen at 18. My actual feeling about having a lot of kids came from my intellectual arrogance. I literally felt that that the world would be better off if I had a lot of my DNA out there. And the intellectual arrogance sometimes, you know, my wife just gets so mad at me when I say that.
When you were a young boy, in addition to having exposure to your father's business, you had entrepreneurial leanings. You had a TV set repair business when you were 10. What was the nature of that?
If you were a geek in the 50s, you were a ham radio operator.
Ham radio, by the way, allowed you to talk to foreigners. Is that correct?
That's correct. Ham radio was an expensive hobby. And so I knew there had to be a way to make more money than the traditional 10-year-old venues. And it really started out by me fixing the family's TV set.
You would go to people's homes to fix their televisions. And there's some folklore that you would buy the parts, let's say, at 10 cents and claim that they were 30 cents to fix.
It was actually more like I'd buy the tubes for about a buck and a quarter. And you typically charge $3 to $5 for a tube.
You worked at amusement parks during college, and so you were surrounded by games, whether it was chess in first grade or the amusement parks. And did you have a sense that you wanted to have a career in game creation, or was that more accidental?
I'm not sure that it was accidental, because I had a certain facility for barkerism, if you would. I mean, I did a lot of debate in high school, and if you really look at the pathway, whether it's ham radio, you know, posing as an adult, debate, barkerism, these were all verbal skills.
Could you show me some of your barkerism?
Oh, absolutely. If you really want a stuffed animal, this is the place to get it. But if you play for 50 cents, that's three times the size animals. And if I was talking to a young man, mm-hmm. I'd say, your girl will love you forever.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Nolan Bushnell, founder of the gaming company Atari and Chuck E. Cheese restaurant chain. You founded Atari in 1972 with a gentleman, Ted Dabney, whom you bought out quite quickly. But before Atari, you had worked at a company called Ampex, which made tape recorders, among other things. And from there, you started your first gaming company called Sysergy. And again, this was right before Atari.
It's the last S in the dictionary, and as a geek, I thought it was a really cool company name.
You started Sysergy and created your first game called Computer Space, which was modeled after a game called Space War that you had
Correct.
Seen. And this was the first coin-operated game.
Correct.
And you then started Atari in 1972. Your first game was Pong. This, too, was kind of a copy of another game you had seen.
Correct.
Can you describe that?
During the 60s, with the big computers, we all programmed a lot of different games. And, of course, one of them was a ping pong game. When I started Atari, our plan was to be the development house, because we had no factory, we had no money. So we thought, we'll sell our skills for royalties. Game over.
So Atari actually started out as a game design business for other people.
Precisely. And so we had these contracts, and our first employee was a guy named Al Alcorn. You know, we'd been in the business for a couple of years, and somebody says, there's a video game being shown in Northern California, and we've got competition. Mm-hmm. So I had to go up and see it, and it was the Magnavox Odyssey, which was the consumer game. I looked at it, and it was fuzzy and a lot of things, and I said, oh, this is no competition at all. But I looked around and saw that they were playing a game of simulated ping pong. People were kind of having fun with it. And I thought, well, this would be a good learning thing. So I defined the game. I said, do a ping pong game for me.
Mm-hmm. To Al.
To Al. And literally in a week, he had it wired up and was working. And as we say, the rest is history.
Why was it so successful initially?
I think that it was the right game at the right time. First of all, it was simple. You could play the game holding a beer in one hand and playing the game with the other. There was also a funny thing, and I'm not sure exactly how important it was, but the typical woman could beat the typical man playing pong. And it was because women have better small muscle coordination than men do. Men have better large muscle coordination, i.e. throwing a ball, that sort of thing. When it comes to just turning the knob precisely, women were much better. And this was just sort of the dawn of women's liberation and all that sort of stuff. And so it was massively gratifying to women to be able to come up and beat the college football hero.
And you debuted Pong at a local bar, and folklore is that you preloaded the machines with coins to make it seem like the machine was more popular than...
No, we actually did that later. This one was just a test. And there were actually lines out the door so that they could come and play Pong.
So when did you preload the machines to make it seem like the machine was more popular than it was?
Well, later on, as we got into production, people always wanted to test the machines. And so we would give the machine to one of our distributors, who would put it into a random location and see how well it did. And so on Sundays, I'd kind of drive around and figure out where the machine was, find it, and put $50 or $200 worth of quarters in it.
Now, it seems like, though, while the game had wide adoption, that a crucial pivot moment for you was a couple years later in 1975 when some engineers came to you presenting a consumer version of Pong.
Correct.
And this obviously caused it to be pervasive internationally. Was there one distributor or one store, chain of stores, that really helped you get the product out to market?
Absolutely. In fact, we did the consumer Pong. We took it to the toy show, and we set up our booth, and we thought that it was going to be a tsunami of people wanting it. We sold zero. And the reason was that toy business at that time sort of had an artificial price ceiling of about $35. And we were trying to get $79 for our unit. And we were somewhat crestfallen.
UNL.
Yeah. And ultimately, we thought, well, maybe we need to sell it through TV shops. And they didn't want to touch it because they were in the business of financing things and they didn't want to finance a game. And finally, we called Sears, and Sears had a sporting goods department that essentially turned into a family room business selling ping pong tables and pool tables for family rooms. And the previous year, they'd had a consumer pinball machine that they sold out of. Mm. And they thought, okay, Pong is in bars. Pinballs are in bars. This is an appropriate thing for us. And so they climbed onto it, and it was a blowout for us.
It's always interesting to me how you have these accidental allies, how really that one decision maker at Sears could have been that fulcrum for you.
Things sometimes are so binary. Mm-hmm. It's really frightening and surprising that they worked for us.
And in the 80s, you saw Pong in places as far afield as Saudi Arabia, where two close friends of mine were allowed to play for 15 minutes a day, except when their parents were shopping, they'd play longer.
Right.
Where are some of the more exotic places that you've seen Pong machines?
Well, I remember distinctly, I was traveling in Spain to one of these up-the-hill fortress cities, and you drive up and you say, gee, I bet I'm the first American that has ever been here. And then you go into the local bar and there was a Pong.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Nolan Bushnell, co-founder of the gaming company Atari. We'll hear more from Nolan coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Nolan Bushnell, founder of the gaming company Atari and Chuck E. Cheese restaurant chain. Nolan is considered one of the pioneers of the video game industry. He was an advisor to Steve Jobs throughout Steve's life. He's the author of Finding the Next Steve Jobs. I want to talk about the culture of Atari that you created. You allowed people such as Steve Jobs to work the night shifts. How come?
I felt that anybody with skill, you should be able to find an adaptation in the workforce to allow that skill to prosper without necessarily it being disruptive to the rest of the environment. And Steve was a little bit difficult. A lot of people really wanted to have him fired because he was direct-spoken and he didn't bathe very often at the time. And I felt, okay, well, I'll just put him on the engineering night shift, which incidentally didn't exist before then. It was partially that, and partially I knew that he and Wozniak hung out a lot, and Wozniak was working at Hewlett-Packard. And so I knew if I put Steve on the night shift, I'd get two Steves for the price of one.
Mm-hmm. You really supported Steve. You paid for his meditation retreats in India. And this is even after he said he was going to stop working at Atari.
Well, that's sort of right and sort of wrong. Mm-hmm. He put in his resignation, and we had a problem in Germany. Nobody wanted to go over and take care of it, but Steve had the skills, and I said, would you go fix the problem in Germany? And he said, yeah, but instead of a return trip, I just want to take that stub of the ticket and go on to India. And I said, fine.
The success of Pong caused you, ironically, not to focus on the computer business. At that time, you had Steve Jobs and Wozniak come to you and say, would you like to buy our little fledgling company, Apple, for $50,000 and own a third of the company? And you said, well, you know what? We're too occupied right now to get involved, and I'd like to stick with the gaming business, because the gaming business was thriving.
Yes.
So it's ironic to me that Pong's success caused you, in a way, to turn down owning a third of Apple. What are your thoughts about that?
It wasn't as much Pong's success as the Atari VCS, the programmable one, which we did in 76. And I think there were two or three issues for me at the time. One, I wasn't convinced that Jobs would be a good CEO. And second, I knew that we had plans to get into the computer business subsequently, but we felt that there needed to be a higher level of integration for a personal computer.
You were right about Steve not being a good CEO, at least initially.
Initially, and I think that one of the unsung heroes of Apple Computer is Mike Markla, who was an extraordinary executive that really brought Apple the gravitas and the adult management that was necessary at the time.
Perhaps it was also Steve's own time in the desert after he was ousted from Apple the first time to really force him to have more maturity and perspective.
You know, there's nothing like a few hard knocks to knock some of the edges off you.
And speaking of a few hard knocks, you had a few dark years yourself after selling Atari to Warner Brothers for $28 million. You butted heads with the Warner Brothers team over how Atari should be run. Ultimately, you left the company. Can you describe what happened?
You know, they were determined to dismantle the corporate culture because it was a little too freewheeling for them, and they were, you know, we used to call them the suits.
One point of contention was with Atari's integration into the restaurant business with Chuck E. Cheese Pizza. Can you describe that?
Yeah, you know, they said, why would we want to be in the restaurant business? And I said, well, it's vertical integration towards the market. I said, we're selling coin-operated games for $1,500 to $2,000 at the time. I said, over their life, they'll earn $30,000 to $50,000. Didn't take rocket science to say that you're on the wrong side of the transaction. You really want to be in an environment where you're collecting the coin. And that's what Chuck E. Cheese was all about.
And you bought the restaurant chain from Warner Brothers for, was it $500,000?
$500,000.
It went bankrupt in 1984.
Things get into trouble after I leave them somehow. And I'm not sure exactly why that is. But as you know, Atari really did a huge hiccup after I left, because when they had sort of dismantled the creative culture, they didn't bring any new games out. And so the fabled 1982-83 implosion of the video game business, totally predictable. In fact, I made more money shorting in Warner stock because I could see it coming than I actually did on the sale. But that's another story.
And similarly, when you left Chuck E. Cheese also, the company suffered.
Yeah, Chuck E. Cheese was never about being in the restaurant business. It was all about a ecosystem around a big game center. Once I solve all the problems, I like to get professional managers in to fix things. And sometimes that doesn't work. And we got a professional guy in that knew the restaurant business, and he wanted to turn it into a restaurant, and with really disastrous results.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Nolan Bushnell, founder of the gaming company Atari and Chuck E. Cheese restaurant chain. I want to talk about Catalyst Technologies, which is the company that you created, or the business incubator, really, that you created after leaving Warner Brothers. And it's striking to me how clairvoyant you've been in predicting technologies even before their time. Some of the companies that you created at Catalyst was a company called Cadabrascope, which was a computer-assisted animation company. Tell me which company it ultimately became.
It ultimately became Pixar.
It seems like a little-known fact to me that you had the germ for Pixar.
It was one of those things where it can be very, very costly to be too far ahead of your time. The technology and the computers, the cost of computer MIPS at that time was incorrect. It really needed to come down in cost by almost an order of magnitude to make it a viable business. I didn't know that when we started it because I said, gee, you know, we can do all this manipulation of graphics. And though we did some really cool stuff, yet it was still cheaper to do it by hand.
And so ultimately you sold it to Lucas.
Right.
And then the company, you know, became Pixar. Part of the reason you had to sell it was you were in financial distress after the Chuck E. Cheese incident. Is that correct?
Yeah, basically I borrowed a lot of money and hypothecated my Chuck E. Cheese stock. And so when Chuck E. Cheese kind of went down, all of a sudden my security covenants went away. And it took me a little while to lick my wounds on that puppy. But more than that, I spent too much money chasing the personal robotics business.
With your company, Androbot.
Androbot. And that was another one where the technology, though close, was not quite good enough.
What were the robots supposed to do, by the way?
Oh, they're supposed to bring you beer.
They collected static electricity along the way. And
yeah, when you have a computer and you get a blue screen of death, nobody gets hurt. You just reboot and carry on. In the robotics business, all of your collision avoidance, all of your safety mechanisms become inoperative. And if you have a 50-pound robot hurtling across the room and the computer crashes, all of a sudden, nobody knows what the outcome's going to be. And we used to have nightmares about a robot running towards a stairwell while somebody was coming up, and all of a sudden you have this 50-pound block of stuff coming down on your head.
I've read that your wife doesn't really like to talk about these years with such failures, and you've mentioned that Nancy put you on a robot 12-step program because you do. That is a love of yours.
It really is. I can't imagine the future without a personal robot.
Another technology that perhaps was before its time, you invented in 1985,
ETAC. Correct.
And that was an
1983.
In 1983, an auto navigation system that became the backbone for what companies?
Google
Maps.
Google Maps, Garmin, any of those. It turns out that the company was successful. I mean, it had a good exit on it.
To Rupert Murdoch.
To Rupert Murdoch, yeah. But it was one of those things where it was very obvious to me that automobile navigation electronic was just around the corner.
How much of your headspace is occupied by these technologies that, if only they were fast-forwarded 20 years, they would work? How much of your psychology do these failures take up versus, you know, the pioneering successes that you've had in your quiet moments?
In my quiet moments, I believe that you never know when the timing is going to be exactly right. And I think as I've gotten older, I'm more patient. For example, my current project is Brain Rush, which is all about changing the dynamics of how people learn using some of the best brain science. I personally believe that it is exactly the right time, exactly the right place.
In addition to the timing being right, the product or the innovation might just have to be tweaked and reinvented a number of times before it works. In your book, you talk about companies like WD-40, you know, having several failures before they finally came up with a product that worked. What does WD-40 stand for?
You know, the 40th iteration of a formula that really cuts grease.
It was also striking to me the number of innovations that have been underappreciated at first due to a failure of imagination, yet turn out to be significantly impactful. You talk about in your book, for instance, the Xerox copy machine. What was said about the Xerox copy machine?
Oh, they said that, you know, why would you need these? You know, carbon paper works really well. And the world's potential market for copy machines is 5,000 at most. The founders of Xerox explained why their photocopier market was not large enough to justify production. You know, it just goes on and on.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Nolan Bushnell, founder of the gaming company Atari and Chuck E. Cheese restaurant chain. In the literature I've read about you, I was expecting much more arrogance. Have you changed at all your disposition throughout your life, your career?
I think a little bit. Early on, I had some tremendous successes at a very young age.
You were 29 when you started Atari.
Correct. And I think that that always gives you a little bit of an elevated sense of self. I was more arrogant in my 20s and 30s than I am now.
What is the cause of the toning down of that arrogance? You know, perhaps in your personal life, for example, with your wife.
Oh, I think my wife thought that I was a jerk.
How did you meet her?
I met her. She was working. She was in pre-law at the university, but her dad owned a restaurant, and she would bartend and waitress over the weekends. And that was right around the corner from the Atari factory. And I just thought she was spectacular, spunky and really smart. And I decided that she was worth pursuing. And so slowly I found out what she thought was objectionable about me, and I modified, at least around her.
What are some examples of the things that offended her?
Oh, I think that she, I would often come in and hold court with a bunch of the Atari employees. It was more of a lord of the manor kind of relationship than a bunch of band of brothers. And she didn't like that. And I think she didn't like, there were a lot of women that were sort of clustering around me. I mean, I was young, and some people thought I was good looking and rich, and that tends to attract a lot of riffraff. And my wife just didn't want to have to deal with that.
So you claimed to her that you would change.
I didn't tell her I was going to change. I changed. I was a good poser. I think I'm a great husband. I can honestly say that we've been married 36 years now, and I would do it all over again. And yeah, I think that she thinks the same way.
To what extent, aside from your wife, did the challenging years professionally, to what extent did that also cause you to just have a little bit more realistic sense of self?
Oh, there is nothing like a major face plant that to say, hey, you're not as cool as you thought you were.
You were a mentor to Steve Jobs throughout his life. And what's striking to me in understanding your life is how many parallels you had with Steve Jobs and with Apple. One is the computers for the masses at Apple versus, you know, gaming for the masses at Atari. Or Steve's poaching people from Hewlett-Packard or from Atari.
Oh, poached a lot from us.
And you poached a lot from Ampex, the company that you had worked prior. Or Nolan Bushnell, your right-hand man was Al Eichhorn, and Steve's right-hand man was Wozniak. And both of your partners were really the engineering minds, and you two were the marketing minds. So you guys seem to pong off each other.
Oh, yeah. Well, of course, I consider myself to be a great engineer, too, though. I think that there are certain kinds of entrepreneurs that see wonderful technology, whether it be the mouse at Xerox PARC with Steve, or seeing the opportunities for video games from the big computer labs. You know, this whole idea of that translation from the very, very esoteric, the very expensive, the very cutting edge into figuring out a way to make it available. And a lot of times it takes a little bit of a cheat.
You had an influence on Steve's life, starting with you and Al Eichhorn employing him at Atari. How was he influential in your life, just on a personal level?
Well, I think Steve, to me, was always a beacon of enthusiasm. And more than that, we used to have these wonderful, wide-ranging conversations about philosophy. I mean, I was always from the school of Hegel and Kant and the Western philosophers, and Steve was more about Confucius and Buddhism and the Eastern philosophers. And I think that the proper synthesis of a life plan is to really have a synthesis between the Eastern philosophical positions and the Western.
And speaking of this fusion, right before we started the interview, you actually did a lotus pose for me, a lotus pose handstand for me, right before we recorded.
Yeah, it's embarrassing. The path to nirvana is, I think, to be as broad in your curiosity and your database as you possibly can. And it really has to do with brain science. For example, a lot of people think, gee, I do the New York Times crossword puzzle every day, therefore my brain is really getting smart. No. It turns out that all the neurogenesis of doing the New York Times crossword puzzle happened probably the first 6 months that you were doing it. And after that, nobody home. I like to play chess. I like to play Go. I'd be willing to bet that 90% of the neurogenesis for me playing chess happened between the ages of second and third grade. And even though I've been playing the rest of my life, nothing there. You've got to do different things.
And you certainly have so many hobbies, from chess to sailing to debate to what else is there?
Well, on my list, I am going to start doing some long-distance bicycling. I just got back from Machu Picchu. I plan to do probably another 6 companies.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
My guest has been Nolan Bushnell. Coming up, we'll meet Roy and Bertrand Sosa, co-founders of NetSpend. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guests are Roy and Bertrand Sosa, co-founders of NetSpend, the first prepaid debit card company for the underbanked population in the United States. NetSpend was launched in 1999 and targets people who don't have access to credit cards or hold bank accounts. Roy and Bertrand started the company out of their one-bedroom apartment in Texas with $750. They later raised $1.5 billion in an IPO in 2010 and sold the company in early 2013 to Total System Services, a payment processing company, for approximately $1.4 billion. They are the co-founders of Empower Ventures, an investment fund focused on financial service companies for the underbanked. Welcome.
Thank you, Jessica.
You immigrated from Mexico to the United States in 1986 when you were teenagers. What were your first impressions of America, Bertrand?
As the World Turns, because I learned English watching As the World Turns with my mother. And the other parts came from watching Transformers in the morning.
How about you, Roy?
Missing the bus, going to my first day of school in Austin, Texas, and having my tennis shoes stolen and not speaking the language. Yeah, it was not a good start. Pretty tough when coming back from a country where, for me, everything clicked.
Now, you moved from Mexico with your mother, and she wanted to kind of reinvent herself. She had been working in business administration, and she wanted to study medicine. Where was your father in this?
Our father, he's a professor of economics, and so they had split a few years back, and so he was in Mexico City.
Roy, you joined the Marine Corps after high school, before entering college. Given your allegiance to Mexico, why did you join the Marines?
Literally, Saddam had invaded Kuwait, and I had been in this country for 4 years, and I had really come to the conclusion that whereas before I wanted to get back to Mexico as soon as possible, I had come to just love this country and the opportunities. And I felt that there was no way that I was ever really going to feel that this was my home the same way that my peers that have been born here. And so I just had this idea of what better way than join the Marines during time of war.
After college, you both worked at MCI, the telephone company.
Now Verizon.
It was at MCI that the idea for NetSpend hatched. And it seems like you are both very unlikely people to start a financial services company, especially given that you were at a telephone company and you didn't have a background in financial services. How did the idea for NetSpend come to be?
We were living together at the time when we overlapped work at MCI WorldCom, and we were just talking about the internet boom and how there's a new business being hatched every day, it seemed like. And so you can imagine, especially in Austin, Texas, Michael Dell has just entered into the picture. And without living in Austin, I don't know if we would have had the momentum of entrepreneurship that we felt. Literally, it happened over a few days where we started talking about doing something together. I remember him walking into my room and saying, I got it. Mm-hmm. We're going to enable payments over the internet.
At the time, e-commerce was just blooming, and people were starting to buy things online. However, there was this whole population of people who didn't have access to credit cards, and the thought was, how are they going to transact? In what way did this stem from your own experience or frustration with the payment system?
As a student at the University of Texas and having had financial aid checks coming in from my GI Bill, I had come to understand that if I came in and I deposited my $2,000 check at my bank account, deposited my check on Friday at 4 p.m., guess what? Even though I had a debit card, I could not get the funds to clear my account until after midnight Monday, which puts it Tuesday. So if I needed to buy books on the internet, or if I wanted to buy flowers for my girlfriend from 1-800-Flowers, I couldn't do anything. The electronics seem to be there. They have my money. Why? Why can't I do this? And that was really what motivated us to say, we cannot possibly be the only ones.
While it was the early days, prepaid cards did exist in the form of phone cards, for example. And in what way did phone cards inspire you to just apply it to a different area?
In a big way for me. I mean, we were working directly in the industry, and we had context coming from Mexico where very popular way of transacting.
When we were at MCI, one of our college jobs initially was to sign people up to switch in long distance. And curiously enough, switching people from AT&T to MCI, that was easy. The ones that were super difficult were not only immigrants, but your average American that had gotten a $400, $500 phone bill, and they couldn't pay it. And they had gotten so burned with that experience that they decided, you know what, I'm going to buy prepaid cards. And we could tell that customer, Mr. Customer, you know, you can have the service for 5 cents a minute, and the prepaid card is 30 cents. And the customer would tell us, yes, I know. I know it's more expensive. But you know what? When I'm done with the card, I'm done with the card.
More control.
It's control. As a person, I have problems about maybe not exercising enough, maybe not having the right diet. And certainly, I'm going to have a problem with spending and saving. And if you can give me something where I can have control, that would be very powerful.
You launched the company with $750, which is basically the amount of money that it costs to incorporate.
$750 was utilized to incorporate, and that was really the catalyst to no going back.
So we put a list of friends and family, and it's really funny, the 20 people that we put on the list, they ended up not giving us any money. But what we ended up getting, these first investors are former employees at MCI. So think about people that were call center agents. When you're talking about an investment from a friend or a former employee that is $5,000 when their annual income, I know for a fact because they used to work for me, was $60,000, it's a big deal.
And then you looked to venture capital and you got a lot of no's because you didn't have experience. What were some other reasons why venture folks did not support you initially?
I'll give you the response that we got from one particular investor that we were looking for money from. And he looked at us and he said, you guys are hilarious. It's like you're trying to go to the Super Bowl and win, but you've got two players. I mean, I didn't even know what venture capital was mm-hmm. when we were looking for venture capital.
You ended up raising money from the help of the Small Business Administration. They had this SBIC program, which insured investments from venture funds, right? It backed or collateralized investments from venture funds. Is that right?
That is correct.
They supported one of our investors, early investors, they had received some money from the government, and it turned out that we were one of the portfolio companies of the year for the government.
And who was the venture firm?
Jeffenor
here out of New York.
In the early days, you persuaded MasterCard to partner with you. How did you meet them?
We were introduced to them by our partner bank out of Texas.
And to their credit, they were very open. You got to remember, 1998, the internet is expanding. And back in those days, we basically said, look, we have an agreement with ExxonMobil for distribution of these cards. They need to be able to get their cash into the system. And how are you going to deal with that? And if you don't want to help us, that's fine. But then this is our first stop, and maybe we can go to American Express, or maybe we can go to Visa, but somebody's going to do it.
So Exxon was a real important ally for you in convincing the likes of MasterCard to work with you.
ExxonMobil being Fortune 1.
So, for example, when you think about MasterCard or Visa, they do not issue cards. Banks do. The biggest retail bank in America back then had a total of 5,000 branches. ExxonMobil had 15,000 locations. So the concept that you can actually reach people through a retail location instead of a bank branch was really an innovation in itself. The other thing that we also had was our technology. So because the stuff that we wanted to do had never been done before, the incumbents, they were very rigid. If you as a bank said, I want to change this and that, they would say, okay, we can make those changes, but it's going to cost you millions of dollars and it's going to be 2-3 years. They also were operating on mainframes. We had the benefit of, we were working on servers from the internet age, where instead of spending $20 million on infrastructure, we could do it for a couple million dollars faster, better.
How did you convince Exxon to make your cards available to the population?
They took a leap of faith on a pilot in Texas. And so literally hopped on a plane, went to see them in Fairfax, Virginia, said, hey, we want to do this. Here's a card. I remember putting a card in front of the gentleman that handled U.S. distribution for their C-stores. He picked it up, looked at it. This, by the way, had been a card that I had designed personally and printed and laminated and all that. And I remember he looked at it and said, okay, let's do it. And he signed the term sheet.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guests are Bertrand and Roy Sosa, co-founders of NetSpend, a pioneer of prepaid debit cards for the underbanked. Launched in 1999, NetSpend provides cards and other financial services to people who don't have access to credit or bank accounts. It occurred to me that you are innovating at the bottom of the pyramid. You're serving people who have real needs, and one day these services will be or eventually were used by mainstream customers. And usually when we think of innovation, sometimes it happens top down, like at the top of the pyramid, and then eventually, you know, the people at the bottom would benefit. Have you thought about that dynamic?
We have. Today, globally, we now have programs in places like Kosovo, where we completely help rebuild the entire financial system in terms of the infrastructure for card issuance and acceptance. And, you know, the small business owner that now can order enzymes for his dairy business that he couldn't before.
Enzymes, yeah.
And that he couldn't do it before. And you asked this question of, you know, you started innovating at the bottom of the pyramid. Well, we have to be super low cost. You obviously can't talk about big fees. We have programs where literally we make $1 per customer per year. Okay, so for you to make it work, you have to leverage technology, you have to leverage partnerships. But once you do that, then all of a sudden you say, wow, I can actually deliver services to the top of the pyramid more efficiently, better service than the incumbents that have been used to high fees. Because I had to figure it out. So instead of building a branch, I partnered with a grocery store. Instead of building a branch, I partnered with an airline.
Or a telco.
You are no longer affiliated with NetSpend. You started an investment fund called Empower, which invests in financial service companies serving the underbanked population. And unfortunately, it got off to a rough start in that you were the subject of a lawsuit and injunctions were filed against you from NetSpend, from the very company that you founded. And that was a tumultuous period for you, I'm sure. And the company contended that you were taking employees and that you had a non-compete and that you were starting companies that competed directly with NetSpend. What was your response to that?
No, my 2 cents on that is that it was a silly time for both of us. There was just no reason for it. We cleared the air between both sides.
The short answer is I can tell you all those things were dismissed. But at the same time, I will also tell you, because of confidentiality on the dismissal and whatnot, we really don't talk about it. But I can tell you from a human perspective, it is the equivalent of being sued by your child. For me, it was even more awkward as a founder to think about the fact that, okay, at the time, we were the largest individual shareholders. So if Netspend won, we lost. But if Netspend lost, we lost. And it just didn't make sense. You know, I've never sued anybody in my entire life. To me, it's disappointing when companies or individuals view the game as a zero sum. Like, if you're winning, I must be losing. So how do I get a piece of that? Netspend had the opportunity to go international for many years. Never did. There's nothing that prevents them from doing that.
So what you're saying is Netspend decided not to go into these other markets internationally, and there you saw an opportunity elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, we started doing things around mobile payments right away and going into other countries right away. And, you know, the product line spectrum that we have today is pretty significantly different than what you see back then.
Your focus now is on Rev Worldwide, which is a portfolio company of Empower, and they have a network of payment companies for those without access to banking. So similar to Netspend, but international. What are some examples, or who are some of the people whom are being affected by this?
In rural Mexico, there's no cell phone coverage. There's no mobile coverage. So we partnered with the telegraph company and with Huawei, who actually came in and put a satellite antenna, and we enabled everybody in a township of 500 families to be able to operate and be able to have both access to telecommunications, but also to the banking system.
The people in Mexico that are using the Mi Phone product are impacted in a very, very real way. I mean, you have this merchant that's selling chicken, and now because he's able to take phone orders and have them be paid to his cell phone, he doesn't have to go to the collect the cash and then take the cash to the bank. And, you know, all these inefficiencies that when you think about, I mean, we may take them for granted, but when for somebody to go half a day across town, another half a day, come back, it's a big deal. Mm-hmm. It's a big deal in terms of time and money. And we have successfully bridged that divide through the mobile phone and through a debit card. Another way that Rev is impacting around the world, you're talking about cab drivers in Australia that are getting paid via their driver's card. Through our technology, their headquarters disperses the money directly to them. And, you know, I can go on and on about all the different examples.
Your mom is living in Texas currently. What does she make of all this?
It's really funny you ask that question, because throughout the early years at Netspend, I don't think she really understood what we were doing. When it relates to things about work, it's more about I need to, you know, help her reset her pen, or I get a tickle out of that every single time.
Where was your father in this?
My father, who's a professor, he still would like for me to go out and finish some sort of graduate school. He's never been a big pro-capitalist or entrepreneur supporter, so there's a bit of unfinished business there.
You said your father's a professor of economics in Mexico?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hmm. Is he socialist?
How did you guess? Why would have led you to believe that?
All you have to do is meet my mother and my father to understand why Roy is half mission-driven and half capitalistic-driven.
I grew up going to summer camps with the Boy Scouts, and every other year going to summer camps with the Cuban Pioneers. And I grew up with a poster of a $6 million man next to the poster of Ernesto Che Guevara.
They
go hand in hand. I don't think you divorce one from the other.
You guys are two immigrants from Mexico, and Netspend had a $1.5 billion IPO in 2010, more recently was sold for almost $1.5 billion. Were you like, is this really happening to me?
Yeah, I all the time. You know, what I really pinch myself is, it's not necessarily the IPO or Netspend or the prepaid. I pinch myself that I was able to find the path of entrepreneurship. When I discovered that entrepreneurs, it wasn't necessarily a dirty word, But it was a very, again, a very empowering feeling. It blew my mind.
I want to elaborate on that concept of dirty word. From an entrepreneur's perspective, in Mexico, an entrepreneur is somebody who doesn't know what they want to do. Being an entrepreneur is the guy that is just sort of wheeling and dealing. And so it's fantastic to really have come to a country at a time where this is really exploding. And if you can believe that, a couple of Mexican immigrants that came in on a tourist visa, that the visa had an expiration date, and that by all means should not be here, that we could create a company that could lead an industry, that could create so many jobs.
That is extremely empowering.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
My guests have been the financial service entrepreneurs, Roy and Bertrand Sosa. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.